All right, John, the Arms with Glenn.
And John.
And thanks to all of our patrons for supporting our show, and welcome to a pre-recorded show. What's the thing?
The future of the past and the present.
We're coming to you from the future, in the past,
in
at the present.
Yes.
That's a lot confusing. So, patrons, don't forget, today is the last day of our giveaways, which we have to say now, no purchase necessary, or no greater purchase necessary, because you've already purchased something to be a patron.
Yeah.
We have to say no greater purchase
necessary. Everyone's equal?
I don't like saying that at all.
No, that's what it is. Everyone is equal.
I'm not going to say that. All right, so all of you guys don't have to do anything extra. Okay, how about that? Our giveaway is the Microbat Systems, two of their candy pouches. That's going to be your favorite quote from our show and reference the show number or show name.
Yeah.
Based on the quote that the guy from Microbat liked, which is where Ryan and I were talking about religion, and we were talking about homosexuals at Chick-fil-A, and I said, I don't want to watch anyone make out while I eat a chicken sandwich. So based on that, that was what he decided to go with. And then for our security lights, your top five security tips for the home.
Bear mode.
Ryan's number one is always bear mode. All right. So today is the last day. By midnight today, you have to have your entries in. And there's not a lot of entries right now.
Well, technically not today, but today when you hear it.
Today when you hear it, which is actually a week from now. Keep up, John. All right?
I have to explain that to you every time we do this.
I'm still confused about being in the past, dude, or future.
So we're recording a show today in the present to be broadcast in the future. But in the future, when they hear it, it will be the past. But it will also be the present. It's the future past of the present.
So when we listen to it, I can tell you, you sound so much younger.
On the May the 13th, all right, whatever day that is, that's going to be the last day, midnight.
There you go.
Committee of Teacher Will See release their new recommended guidelines for tourniquets.
I was totally shocked.
You guys are all going to be sad to hear that the rats again did not make the list. But don't fear, the guys who made the rats are currently engaged in an argument with not just our good friend Andrew Fisher, but also the entire committee at TCCC about how their policies are based on, and I quote, the internet.
The internet.
The internet. They just can't let it go, man. They just can't let it go. Anyways, there's actually some really cool new piece of equipment, so it's not just the cat and the freaking soft T wide anymore.
Right.
There's the ratcheting mechanical tourniquet, the RMT, which was kind of surprising. The TX2 and the TX3 ratcheting tourniquets, which were surprising.
And the Samlin?
And the Sam XT, which was kind of surprising because I thought it was breaking a lot. But my favorite one that made the list was the TMT from Combat Medical.
Pretty excited about that one.
Yeah. So they expanded the list from 2 to like 7. So that's really cool. And then there were some other expansions with airway guide and what else was there? Hemostatics.
Hemostatics
I think stayed the same.
I thought there was a few that were...
No, I think it's the same stuff. It's because the X-Stat and Hemcon were already on the list, and then the other two were there. So, yeah, it's cool stuff. You can look at the list, just look it up, or you can email us if you can't find it. We'll send you one. We'll send you a copy. But a lot of cool new stuff on the TCCC list, so that's good news. June 15th, if you're an alumni, June 15th is our big alumni class. It's going to be a force-on-force concealed carry class, so you should definitely check that out.
It's going to be fun.
It's going to be a good time. We're going to shoot people a lot. All right. We don't really have, you know, our normal news because it's a pre-recorded show, so we don't really have anything particular to talk about. I'm sure politicians were still corrupt, and some people did good things, and a few people did shitty things, and also we're still at war.
That's weird.
FYI. Yeah, someone was curious or forgot.
Yeah.
Or wondered.
18 years later, we're still fighting.
If only we would have known.
Yeah, well, there are literally people joining now that were not alive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When 9/11 happened.
Yeah, that's true. How insane is that? I think that was actually, I read a thing
there in the Army Times. There was a Marine. The first one I saw was, there was a Marine in boot camp. Mm. It was born like September 3rd or 4th.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Or no, not 3rd or 4th.
No, it would have been after September 11th.
Yeah.
You're doing terrific, John.
Stay with it, buddy.
Math. Math's hard. Screw you guys.
Hang in there.
I don't know weaponized math or math at all, actually. So
I got my story I can tell.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What's your story? Yeah.
Here, swing the mic this way.
Okay, so. Okay. Here's your mic.
All right. So, dropping the little one off of school today. So, obviously, I have to take my magazine, pistol, knife off and everything. Put it into my safe. You know, put it down. Drop off the little one, get back in my car, put everything back on, and I'm driving. And then all of a sudden, my crotch is fucking burning. it fucking feels like it's on fire.
Hmm.
Yeah. Like I just fucking shot.
Like dumped some Tabasco sauce or something down your pants?
Yeah, or I just shot like 100 rounds and then put the pistol back in my holster. Something along those lines.
Flashlight?
Bingo. But I did not fucking realize it. I was like, what the fuck is going on? And I pull out my pistol, and all of a sudden I see that my light's on. And I'm like, motherfucker. Burning my dick. That's my story.
So, proper light. What's the moral of the story?
Light discipline.
Don't ND with your light. Light discipline?
It got clipped on the holster when I was putting it in.
Mm. Was your weapon light or your pistol? Yeah. Or your handheld light? No, your weapon light?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think it burns bright.
Oh, yeah.
Burns brightly.
Very bright.
Good thing it wasn't nighttime. You start getting shot at someone shoots you right in the dick.
Can only hope that I can get my metal dick.
Oh, man, what a dream. Is the VA passing those out now?
I mean, what
you... I might actually start going back to the VA if they're passing out metal dicks.
Well, I mean, you want your metal arms. That's what you're hoping for.
I do hope for my metal arms.
Yeah, you want arm cancer. I want my dick blown off so I can get a metal dick.
Yeah.
So,
I think I'm good with what I've got. It all seems to be working mostly at this point.
I want metal arms, like, yeah,
like Doc Ock type metal arms.
Oh man, like Jax from Mortal Kombat.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I got you. I can see that.
I can finally be a jacked.
I want my kangaroo legs and a kangaroo tail. You ever seen the...
What?
I'm sure you've seen it. A kangaroo fucking kick someone?
Yeah.
That's badass.
It's fucking hilarious.
You ever see that dude box that kangaroo?
Yeah.
When it was eating that dog or whatever and he wanted...
It was like attacking his dog and he just like
runs up and...
Whammo!
Holy shit.
I wonder what the number is of how many kangaroo deaths there are every year.
Like people killed by kangaroos or how many...
Red Wire Gear Mom and Go while I Google fucking kangaroo deaths.
All right, so buy and use an appropriate holster for your handgun, and make sure it's your correct application. So drop legs, see a lot of the drop leg holster has become the chagrin of a lot of people across the world. There's a very limited application for an actual drop leg with the advent of the offsets and the drop offset holsters out there. So just be aware of your use for your holster. In waistband, on waistband. If you do a lot of hiking and backpacking and mountain bike riding and stuff, there's a lot of nice systems you can get to mount one to your chest.
Hill People Gear.
Hill People Gear system's pretty badass. So there you go. Buy the right holster for your gun. Buy the right holster for your application. That's all I got today.
Redwire Gear Moment brought to you by RedwireGear.com. Kangaroos are usually peaceful animals, and as they are vegetarians, would not attack humans because animals normally attack because they need food or out of self-defense. Despite their peaceful appearance, they are formidable fighters. There's only like a couple actual recorded attacks, so sorry, Ryan.
Recorded, so there could be more.
He said... Yeah, there could be some secret underground
kangaroo fights.
Kangaroo attacks.
Yeah. What happens in the outback stays in the outback.
I guess so. All right. Moving on to our topic. Our guest today, Josh
Super
from
weird.
Independence Training, in the studio to talk with us about long range training. So thanks for coming in and talking with us, Josh.
Yeah, buddy.
So Josh, you've been in long range shooting now for how long? In one way or another.
One way or another. Let's see. Time for some math, John.
Oh, God. Here we go.
01 to now.
18 years.
There you go. Look at you.
Yeah.
You didn't even have to use your calculator.
Nope. I had it ready, though. I was like, I might need this.
All right. So 18 years. And there's – first, let's talk about the difference between long range or precision. By your definition, what's the difference between – when people talk about long range, when people talk about precision, what are really the things that separate those two things?
Usually just the accuracy requirements. I mean, you see all the new EOR trends, people shooting 5,000 yards now and stuff. They're just shooting at a huge-ass plate, which is still, you know, a feat in itself. But at some point, you're getting into ordnance, you know. If we want to get technical with it, a 155 holds the accuracy long-range record.
Right.
Yeah, you're right.
Right. Yeah, what is the MOA capability of a 155?
Yeah, I have no idea.
What's their accuracy potential?
I don't know. Let me text them.
All right, you guys find it out.
I know a guy.
I'm on it.
No, Ryan's all over that. So 18 years doing long range shooting. What are some of the big in that time frame? What are some of the biggest changes that you've seen in the world of long range shooting?
Man, I'd say
like the top three or top five biggest changes.
Biggest changes.
Yeah,
I'd say more just different direction the sport's going. I mean, there's so many different ways that it's going. I mean, you can get into the 22 rimfire series stuff now, and all the way up into the big ELR where they're running the 300 PRCs, the 338s, the Shytax. I mean, so that just the range that you have to work in now is just impressive. Where it used to be, you know, the 308s and the 223s, the 6mm.
So the expansion of equipment is helping people be able to do more then. Basically.
Oh, absolutely.
I know skills are kind of always the same, right? But do you think that there has been an increase in people's ability just because of our understanding of how the game is played or how long range shooting is done? Or is the skills set kind of now what it's always been and just the equipment's allowing us to take it further?
I'd say the skill sets are getting better because it's getting more popular and you have more people getting involved in it.
So people, I think, with long-range shooting always kind of look at like a military sniper, and we'll take it from the most basic level of a, you know, not a designated marksman, but an action, you know, someone who's actually graduated sniper school but maybe necessarily isn't in a special operations unit or whatever. People look at that as kind of like, oh, man, I know my cousin was a sniper or whatever, and that means he's a fucking badass shooter. What is the accuracy requirement? Because I know you've done a lot of training, you've got a lot of real world experience in it. What is the accuracy requirement for that? Do you think that from a military sniper perspective, it is more long range or more precision, or is that more unit specific?
That's real unit specific. You know, the number they always throw out is one MOA. That's what everybody talks about, that this is one MOA or sub MOA. And that's kind of like the standard for accuracy. But then inside of that, that's all dependent on what the actual unit is. You know, for like most Leo, it's like 300 and in, even if they can get to 300, you know, more specifically like 100 and in for most of their true applications. You know, the militaries, they still go out to 1,000 plus. But.
So you don't think really, from an accuracy perspective, it's still kind of really more of a long-range shooting game? From a general, we'll say, sniper perspective, that's more of a long-range game. We need to hit stuff far away just to put it down, as opposed to we need to be more precise until we start getting into more specific. Because like you said, with law enforcement, the average national law enforcement sniper shot's like 76 yards or something.
Yeah, 76,
like that.
73, 60-something.
It's freaking close, relative. But their accuracy requirements are going to be much tighter because they have a lot more collateral damage. And then you go to something like an FBI HRT type sniper qual, which is even tighter than that because they're like half minute, aren't they?
I can't remember what it was. It's been
tight, I remember.
I did one of their courses. More math for you. No, it was about 15 years ago, 13 years ago. I did an FBI course. And I can't remember what the requirements were for it then.
Now, if we switch over to the civilian side of things from like a competitive world, like most of the competitions you go to now, coming from that type of experience and now going and shooting really more competitive stuff, do you see that the competition world is more accuracy-based or more long-range-based?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, on one of the stages, the tiebreaker stage at the match I just came out of was a accuracy. You shot a four-round group on the clock, and it was measured with some crazy ninja device downrange at 300 yards. And whoever shot the tightest group won any of the tiebreakers.
So are you seeing then that the trend in competition is definitely more accuracy-based as opposed to just distance-based or time-based?
Yeah, it's definitely an F-class game now. If you're going to be a top competitor, you have to be running close to F-class accuracy at this point.
So what are some of the trends that you're starting to see in competition that – and by trends, I mean things that are happening now that it's like if you're not doing this, if you're not – practicing like this or you're not running this kind of equipment, you're probably not, you know, that competitive. What are some of those trends that you're starting to see?
Well, really kind of depends on what you're going to try and get out of the sport to start with. But, I mean, if you want to be one of the top-level competitors right now, I mean, those guys are shooting 2 to 3 to 4 times a week, you know, and you're talking a couple hundred rounds a week or more. And, I mean, they're running guns that are, like I say, they're close to F-class quality guns. And that's if you want to be in the top, that's where you're going to have to play.
So what about someone like when I go shoot long-range competitions, you mean, you know, you shoot competitions with me. I'm mostly there just have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm competitive in that I'm
– the noise.
And I'm better than the average shooter, but I am not a top-level long-range shooter because that's not really my game. It's something I enjoy doing. It's something we teach and all that, but it's not, I'm not super dialed in on the competitive side of things. So for me, like I show up, I've got a relatively factory gun. I'm shooting factory ammo. I've got a relatively good but kind of common optic. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm using common stuff. You know, I've got the common bipods, the Atlas that everyone has. I've got a common type tripod or a common type bag. And even when I show up to different competitions, I look at them, I'm like, oh my God, like look at all the shit this guy has. Like this is some cool stuff. Like, I, you know, the last time we shot together, your switchable freaking bipods. Who makes those again? Something Element or something like that?
Modular Evolution.
Modular Evolution. I mean, those are freaking cool. You know, like the ability to go from a short to a medium to a tall freaking bipod just super fast is absolutely crucial when you're dealing with certain types of stages. And that's something that a few years ago, we didn't see that.
No.
You know, we were all running the same stuff. You know, and now as equipment's advanced, it seems almost like the equipment is being driven by the competitions, which means that match directors are kind of building matches based on the assumption that people are going to have access to a certain type of equipment. Because I know even some of the competitions like we shot last year together, there was a couple times where, you know, I've got some really good equipment compared to what the average long-range shooter is going to have. But compared to the average long-range competitor, I don't have really good equipment. And I show up and I'm like, oh my God, like I wish I had that thing or that is a freaking cool setup or whatever. So what do you see that like from an equipment standpoint that people are – that there's trends in the competitive world where it's like if you don't have these types of things, you're probably going to be behind the curve?
There's a lot of stuff out there, and I mean, it's just like anything in the industry, you know, it's going to get driven. So even like the Modular Evolution that you like, that's old news now, and there's already a better one out there that I'm waiting to get my hands on right now. The SkyPods come out, and they're the new cool because they're the
cool. I didn't see those. Yeah,
they're the do everything that mine, the few things that mine can't do, those can do, you know. So then on match director side, talking about the match directors, you know, they have to take that into consideration, and that's why the matches keep getting harder and harder and harder because the competitors are getting that much better and the equipment's getting that much better. It's making it that much easier. You know, it used to be a feat to shoot a 3 MOA at 1,000. Now that's basically a gimme target almost to some of these guys. You know, we're running down to that one MOA, half MOA targets to keep it competitive. You know, that destroys your average novice shooter, but if you're going to find out who's the champion, you have to put targets like that into these matches to find that dividing line between them.
Well, I remember it wasn't that long ago when we started really shooting these matches and started with, like, the team matches. And back then, you know, we were running pretty basic tripods, and everyone was running pretty basic tripods, and there wasn't really anything out there that was drastically better than what we had. Fast forward, you know, a handful of years, and now you've got $1,200 tripods out there being used. Do you think that stuff like that, like you mentioned, there's certain things that kind of crush the average shooter. Do you think things like that are a barrier to entry for a shooter, or can a shooter who's like, dude, I don't have all that crap, can a shooter like that still, I mean, of course a shooter can still go out and compete and have a good time and learn something, but do they even stand like a freaking snowball's chance in hell if they don't have a certain type or piece of equipment? Do you see that from a competitive standpoint?
You see that, but most of the match directors are good enough with it that they'll design it that you can have a, you know, $1,200, $1,500 tripod, and that's great. But if you don't use it, you're going to time out on the stages. Mm-hmm. They'll set the times back. So then trying to drag around that extra piece of equipment, that's going to slow you down and cost you points. So you're better off running without it. So there's ways for workarounds to do everything. So one, basically it all goes back to the one man and one rifle type mentality. If you do nothing but train with just the system that you have, you can still be proficient and still compete. I mean, you honestly, you probably won't be in the top unless you have that type of training regimen to go out and shoot four times a week, but you can still be competitive.
Now, from a different types of matches perspective, because you shoot a lot of stuff. You shoot local matches, you shoot the PRS stuff, you shoot NRL, you know, competition dynamics, a lot of different types of matches. What match do you, when you shoot, do you say this is probably the best for a novice shooter to go try X type of match?
The local matches, 100% local matches. Most pro shooters, when they go shoot local matches, they don't really take it too serious. And they're more willing to try and help new shooters. Or they can even, some local matches will even allow you to coach new shooters while you're on the clock. Like the one we have in Arizona, I like that one in particular because they take all the experienced shooters and they separate them through the entire range. So you have one experienced shooter in squad one, one in two, one in three, one in four. And that way, when you put new shooters in there, they can kind of help coach and teach those new shooters to try and bring the experience of the club level up.
And that what Josh is talking about is the Arizona Long Range Precision Shooter, is AZLRPS. So for those of you guys in Arizona, they've got a Facebook page that you can go to. You can find out all their match information run by Tim and Regina Milkovich and Matt Levine, who are all great shooters and really friendly people. And so if you contact them and say, hey, man, I want to come out to your match, and I'm a freaking newbie. I think that's one of the things that I always like most about the precision matches is it's a really friendly crowd.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really friendly crowd because no one is there. Like, even me on the kind of, I would say if I show up, I'm probably on the lower side of cost of equipment just because I've got mostly factory stuff. I don't have high-end custom rifles that I'm necessarily using. Even if I show up there with relatively decent stuff or whatever, I don't think it's a barrier to entry when I show up, and then I can say to someone else who's got way better equipment than I do, hey, man, can I take a look at that? Hey, do you mind if I use that piece of equipment? Hey, yeah. Can I try your tripod? I've never had to be like, no, this is mine, you know? And you don't see that with all of the competition world. You know, you go to a handgun match and ask someone to shoot their pistol or ask someone to try their holster or something, the likelihood they're going to be like, oh, yeah, here you go. I mean, it's there. Certainly, you might get the right person.
And some people might, but yeah, you're 100% correct. I mean, for just the long-range environment is just – I mean, it's a night and day difference than any of the three-gun and the two-gun matches that we've been at before. You know, you want equipment, or usually you get told to use or try some new equipment by somebody because you show up and you don't have the right bag. And they're like, here, use this bipod instead, or use my bag instead. And now, like the NRL you're talking about, they actually have – they have two fully built custom match rifles that new people can check out and shoot in the match.
That's pretty cool.
I think even, I can't remember, they got a case of ammo for it too.
Really?
So even if you're under geared and you want to go check it out, they have a match rifle readily available for you to use during the entire match.
Well, and even on the low end, like I was saying, I mean, there's still, if I show up to a match and again, kind of being on the, you know, factory level, I've still got thousands of dollars tied up in gear.
Oh, yeah.
Rifle, ammo, optics, tripods, bags. You know, all that stuff, like it's still thousands of dollars.
Yeah, it's definitely not a cheap sport.
Well, I think that the benefit of that, though, is it kind of reduces the douche level. You know what I mean? because the guys who are all there, like everybody understands that even on the low end, people have a lot of money wrapped up in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you see that with the manufacturers, too, because, you know, you have manufacturers who are out there and they're a lot cooler, I think, than some of the other manufacturers as far as letting people try gear, test gear, use gear, be involved, give gear away, you know, things like that, because they know that everyone who's playing this game is playing an expensive game.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and we go to matches, that's also expensive.
Yeah, from a manufacturer standpoint, I mean, just the support they have for the sport is just insane. Like, I don't even know how to explain how much stuff they bring to match tables, you know. The amount of prizes and product and stuff that they give to match tables, and then the stuff that they bring for people to use at matches. Like, I think it was Chris and Bull T-Bone came with us last year to Dog Valley, and they were both working for Timney, you know, and they'd spent almost the entire time they were there working on triggers that weren't even Timney.
I was gonna say, some of them weren't even Timney triggers, and they were fixing them.
Yeah. I mean, it's just things like that you see from manufacturers, and they do it all the time. You know, people will show up, like a guy had a scope break. You know, I know on the NRL side, there's Loophold has a scope, Vortex has a scope, US Optics has a scope, and they're all loaner scopes. So if you have a scope break, they'll give you a new scope so you can finish out the match. They have firing pins. I mean, from every action you can think of, they have all the parts, the pieces, everything that you need. And that's all from manufacturers, you know, playing to help the shooters out. It's just, it's phenomenal what they're willing to do for the sport.
And precision precision matches are the only matches I've ever been to. And I'll preface this with saying, I don't go to matches for the prize table. Like, being in the industry, I get a lot of cool gear to try out. We get discounts. We get great opportunities and all that. So we have an opportunity to get a lot of equipment. I don't go there for the prize table. Some people do go for the prize table because if they win, then they get something that they can either use or sell to buy what they need. And that, or you know, pay for their matches and all that. So that's all cool. That all being said, I've never been to any match where, one, I've been disappointed walking away from the prize table. Yeah. I mean, I've always been like, oh, dude, I really wanted one of those. Or, oh, that's really cool. I have an opportunity to get one of those. And also, I've never been to a match other than a precision match where I've seen some of the top-tiered guys give their prizes to the lower-tiered shooters.
Like, you'll see a lot of people, they'll do, like, the fold, you know? They'll go up there, like you're saying, when you're top shooters, they're like, okay, just fold the paper, fold the scores. Mm-hmm. Or who's the newest shooter? Who's who's the youngest shooter?
Yeah, kids.
Yeah, and they'll give them like full rifles, full setups. I mean, it's just phenomenal, the support and it gets. And like on the manufacturer side, I mean, it's a great opportunity for them to put their products on a table and give it to somebody who, you know, is cost prohibited from it. You know, you get somebody, you try like the other bags we were talking about. You always see them on prize tables, you know. That's a great opportunity for them to get their product out into the hands of people who are actually using it. Mm-hmm. You know, you want feedback on how your product works, give it to the guys who are out there spending money shooting. You know, they're going to give you some feedback on it for sure.
For someone who's getting into competition, do you think it's really important before they start competing, whether it's a local match or they want to get into the NRL series or the PRS series, which I always recommend to everybody, if you're thinking about getting involved in competition, the absolute first step is just fucking going to a competition. Like, this is literally the first thing you have to do. Quit worrying you don't have the right gear. Quit worrying you're not going to be good enough. Quit worrying about all that shit, because it's all true until you go. And then when you go, then you'll find out what actually is true and what isn't true. Oh, maybe you do have the right gear. Maybe you just need to change one thing. Or maybe you are actually better than you might think. I mean, sometimes that's how I like to go to competitions, like long-range competitions, because they're still a big challenge for me. You know, the action matches are a lot of fun. They've kind of lost some of their savor to me because I do well in them often. And it's like I like challenges, you know. So I want to go to long-range matches because they're still a challenge. But I realize that even when I go, I'm still doing pretty good. You know what I mean? I'm still up towards the top of things. And so that kind of allows me to set a watermark of where I'm at and figure out what I need to work on. So what I always recommend to people is just freaking go. But other than that, when you want people who want to go to a competition, are they primarily looking – should people have a reason that they want to be able to shoot a rifle well before they go into a competition other than competing? So like is competition good for hunters? Is competition good for operational snipers, whether that's law enforcement or military? Is competition good for just regular recreational shooters? Obviously, it's good for competitors, but is it good for everyone else?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to know why you're getting into shooting before you go in. I mean, you have to know what you're trying to get out of it, you know? Like, if you're hunting, then you want to go, like, perfect example, I just had Owens build me this badass hunting rifle, right? Mm-hmm. And then, lo and behold, luck hates me again, and I didn't draw a single tag this year in Arizona. So I have this amazing hunting rifle and no way to use it. So I took it to a match 2 weeks ago and shot it. It was a great chance to shake it out. You know, it's the last thing you want to do is the first time you're using your rifle is when you're going to go and try and kill something with it. You have to take it out, ring it out, make sure it works the way you want it to. It was awesome. I wasn't as competitive as I usually am with a hunting rifle, but I mean, it was a great reminder of what the fundamentals are and how you need to apply them if you are going to be competitive.
I think sometimes people approach a competition, especially guys like you and me who are very competitive people, and we go to places to win because that is our purpose and our goal is to do well. Mm-hmm. And then to win doesn't necessarily even mean taking home that first place trophy, but we're looking to accomplish certain things when we show up, and that's our win. And so for us, that's one thing. But for anybody to go to a competition, I think you have to figure out kind of what your win is going to be? Like, is your wind taking your hunting rifle and it never has any hiccups and it shoots well and it shoots accurately? And
yeah, you know, build that confidence in your equipment. I mean, that's the best place you can do it. If, you know, you're on the tactical side of it, or you're a Leo, or, you know, you're just got the hunting rig set up, you know, take that to a local match, shake it out, you know, build a little confidence in it and see what it's truly capable of.
And not try to worry about like, oh, but I'm not going to do as well. It's like, yeah, everybody knows that when you show up with a hunting rifle.
Yeah, when you show up in an 11-pound hunting rifle and you're going against, you know, or 11-pound Magnum, and you're going against, you know, 20-pound centerfiled 6mm, yeah, you're going to be at a little bit of a disadvantage in the sport, but it's understandable that when people find out why you're there, they love it. You know, they'll help you in any way they can.
What do you find where do you see long range shooting going? Because it wasn't that long ago that this sport was not nearly as big as it is now. I mean, when you and I first started teaching precision rifle classes and independence training, 9 years ago or whatever it was, 8 years ago.
My God, has it been that long?
Yeah, it's been a long freaking time. Holy shit. I mean, when we first started teaching it, competitions weren't as easily available. A lot of it was like Camp Perry type stuff or F-class type stuff, or, you know, you'd see some specialized competitions here and there, but you didn't – there was no NRL. I think the PRS was just kind of starting to really get going. You know, you kind of heard a little kind of outlaw type matches going on.
Yeah, it wasn't really on the radar for a lot of people.
So since it's gotten so much bigger and things are really gaining a lot of momentum, and I would say probably in the last, 3 years – 4 years maybe, things are really starting to gain momentum. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the long-range shooting world going? I mean, like, what's the trends that you're seeing in competition or how matches are going that you think, hey, this is kind of going to be the direction of long-range shooting? Do you see it maintaining its popularity? Do you see it maintaining kind of a national exposure like it's got? Do you see it kind of, you know, fading off as other things have? You know, where do you see it going? Where are the matches going? Like, I've thought maybe, you know, like you mentioned earlier, you see the 22 stuff branch off.
Yeah.
You see the NRL kind of branch off from the PRS, which are two slightly different series. You know, you see those kind of things continue to happen. Do you think there's enough momentum in the sport where it's going to continue?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something, I don't want to say it's new, but really, you know, in the history of shooting, it is pretty new. You know, for this style, it's something different, you know, and people like different. You see a bunch of the three-gun guys and the two-gun guys and the pistol guys, they're all coming into the PRS side or the NRL side. You know, those guys are starting to find interest in it because it's something new. It's a new challenge for a lot of people. And it's fun. Like we talked about before, the people are awesome. You know, we don't have a bunch of douchebags fucking running around being assholes to new shooters and stuff. Actually, new shooters are encouraged to.
And I think it's an easier thing, too, to go and have fun in because you've got dude, what the fuck is that?
I have no idea.
Are they revving a motorcycle in the garage behind us or something? Mm-hmm. This is super freaking loud. But you've got okay, thanks. You've got – as people come into the different matches and they're looking at kind of like what they want to get out of, like you said, pistol and carbine shooters starting to get into it for a challenge – Do you see people still competing, like with the people that you compete with? Do those people still go and compete in the other matches, or do they really start focusing more and more on the long range? Like, I know that's the direction that, you know, you took when we first started really competing together. It was like, yeah, we're going to do a little bit of everything. We're going to do all these pistol matches and carbine matches. And that lasted for a while until a lot of long range stuff really started. Do you see that kind of trend with other people where they kind of start to leave the other stuff behind and really start to delve into long range?
I think you will a little bit because it's like anything, you know, you get something new going, you get excited about it and you put all your time and effort into that, but that's going to wear sooner or later and you're going to go back to trying to be, you know, the jack across all the sports, you know, like I still like to shoot pistol and carbine and shotgun whenever I get a chance, but definitely right now long range takes the precedence on all that just because it's something I really enjoy.
When you're looking at the different types of matches and their focus, the majority of matches, are they really – and we kind of talked about this a little bit earlier about the focus of, you know, accuracy and distance or long-range shooting versus precision. Do you see the matches, again, as we kind of continue on in the future, just so people can know what to expect, do you see those matches focusing more and more on distance to try to challenge people, or are they going to start focusing more and more on accuracy to challenge people, and kind of what is that trend that you've seen?
That kind of goes to where the match is being hosted at. Distance is hard. I mean, the equipment and the capabilities are there now that it's really challenging to get far enough on physically to challenge most of the shooters. Mm-hmm. So then you have to go to target size after that. You know, trying to find a place that lets you shoot out to 1,200 yards is no easy task. You know, there's only a couple in the valley down here that you can do it. So trying to find a huge facility that allows it is the biggest issue at the time. If you can't find the distance, you have to go to the target size or go to the time. You know, and the good match directors, they combined all three of those. So you have a little, you know, you have some stages that are really time tight. You get some stages that are really small targets, and then you get a couple of real far targets.
Most of the matches that I've been to, it seems like the max range tends to be 1,200 on average. You know, I've obviously been to matches where it's gone out to 14, 15, even they'll put some crazy ass freaking 1,800 yard target, but mm-hmm. that's the exception as opposed to the rule. What's your, I mean, obviously you go to way more matches than I do. What's the average long distance for someone who's going like, okay, I want to get into this. How far do I need to know my data? What do you think you definitely should have your data out to X before you go to this match?
I'd say you're pretty much right on it. Like the long target usually is at 12, 13, 14 would usually be your long. But the majority, I would say, on all these across the board on all the stages is that 700, 500, 600, 700 range. That seems to be like where most match directors really like to play at. So as long as you're solid on your numbers right there, you have a good chance.
And from an accuracy perspective, it seems like, you know, I've been to some matches where – it's like, dude, you're shooting at barn doors the whole time, and it's just how fast can you hit the barn door? And so how fast can you, you know, slam the freaking bolt home, get in position, and whack this barn door? And, you know, wind is even – people are like, fucking left edge or whatever. Like, it's a rough wind call because the target's so freaking big. And then other matches you go to where it's like, dude, you're shooting 10-inch plates at 5, 6, 700 yards. When we see that trend towards accuracy, if someone's going to say, okay, I need to have a round – like, my data has to be – tits on solid out to 800 for sure, you know, which I typically see that in the matches I shoot, like 600 to 800 tends to be where most of the stuff happens, with very few shots being taken inside of four. Most of the stuff I see taken inside of four, just from my experience, has been offhand, you know, kneeling, sitting stuff.
Positional. Even the positionals are done at like 300 now.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're even starting to work out. But I mean, I'm saying like inside of 400, it's probably going to be positional, or it's going to be a really small target, or it's going to be some really weird position, like you're shooting out of a hot tub like we did that one time or whatever. Like, it's going to be weird stuff like that. But other than that 6 to 8, so like I got to have perfect data here. I should have a good idea, or as good a data as I possibly can get, out to, you know, 12 to 1400. So then from an accuracy perspective, how tight do things need to be? Like, you know, you mentioned minute of angle or sub-minute of angle. So for anyone listening who doesn't understand that, minute of angle basically is 1 inch per 100 yards. So that's 1 inch at 100, 2 inches at 200, 10 inches at 1,000, right? So 2 inches at 1,000 would be – or 2 minutes of angle, I mean, at 1,000 would be 20 inches. So everyone can just kind of keep up with the math. So if we're talking about in minutes of angle, what do you typically see someone needs to be able to hold – on average, what kind of, I hate to use the word group because a lot of them are shot on steel, so it's kind of hard to know. Yeah. But what's a rough accuracy expectation for rifle ammo targets?
I would say if you're over a minute of angle, it shouldn't probably go to a match. I mean, you can, but you're going to struggle. If you're under a minute, I'd take it to a match. If you're under a half, you're on it. That's what you want to see.
And how are people going to judge that? They're going to say, okay, I can hold a 1-inch group at 100?
Yeah. How would I judge it?
Is it a 1-inch group? What if?
Because you're looking just the rifle and just the ammo itself and just the shooter off a bench or prone. I'd say, you know, you want to at least be under a minute.
So bench,
because prone, most of rifle, your targets ammo are going to be less than 2 MOA off a prop. So if you can't do it prone with your equipment inside one, you're going to have a really hard time at a match.
So from a solid position, bench or prone, at 100 yards, on paper, you should be able to hold a minute or sub-minute.
Yep.
So inch or less group. That's a good reference. So then is that in your – where you've seen the matches go, like, for example, the match you just came from, do you see that was more distance-based or was it more accuracy-based? I mean, you said the tiebreaker was pretty freaking accuracy-based, but the rest of it, was it more distance-based or more accuracy-based?
I think – the far out there was 1335, I think, was the far target. And there was just two long range stages. out of the 24 stitches shot. The rest of it was all inside that, you know, well, I'd say inside 800 to about 300. Every other, all the other stages were inside that spectrum. But a lot of it was all off barricade or some sort of barricade, off a car or a rooftop or a ladder or a cargo net, you know.
So then once people start practicing to shoot off of props, 2 minutes roughly should be the goal? 3 minutes?
Yeah, I'd say two.
2 minutes?
So you can keep it within two.
All right. So again, math-wise, that would mean at 300 yards should be holding about 6 inches. So you don't have to necessarily – if you have the paper capability or a range capability to test on paper, that's great. But, you know, you can get various types of steel and do the same thing. And for those of you guys who have big steel and you're like, oh, but all I have is an 18-inch gong, like, fine, just paint some different size circles on them and say it's got to land inside that white circle. So a 2 minute from a prop, a 1 minute from a prone or bench is where people should be roughly in order to feel like, hey, I could go there and I could do pretty well. And for those listening, that is not that hard to accomplish. I mean, everyone who goes to our classes is easily that by lunchtime on day one. So it's not – this is not a very difficult thing. I would say out of all the factors, skill being removed because skill is the biggest variable. But just from the factors of equipment, I would say ammunition probably has the biggest impact on that. Would you agree? Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty easy to get a system put together now that's sub-MOA. I mean, the ammo manufacturers out there, they're like anything else. You know, they just keep getting better and better, you know. So it's – you don't even have to hand load anymore to be competitive. Yeah, I mean, you can buy a factory, you know, factory ammo just straight from the dealers, and it's good enough now that you can be competitive in these sports.
Well, an interesting thing about just the, like you mentioned, the guns, the manufacturers, the ammunition manufacturers, everything was, last year I got that Tika. Yep. You know, I wanted a nice lightweight hunting rifle, and so I kind of thought about it and asked Josh, hey, man, what do you think is a nice lightweight good hunting rifle? He recommended this Tika T3X, which was freaking 5.5 pounds, right? The super light Tika T3X weighs nothing. Went out, got this lightweight 6.5 Creed, got a little bit of work done to it, threw a nice piece of glass on it, and it's a half minute of angle gun with the Hornady Precision Hunter ammo, right? So growing up with our hunting rifles, Josh grew up hunting, I grew up hunting, we weren't certain shooting no freaking half minute of angle rifles. You know what I mean? Like your granddad's 243 or, you know, dad's 25-06 or whatever were very accurate guns, but we never, I mean, at least I never really thought about, dude, you went down to the gun store and you bought whatever ammo they had for your gun. Maybe you had a couple different choices. If you had a couple different choices, you shot whichever ones you had to make sure you had the best group. But we weren't thinking half minute of angle groups with hunting rifles.
Yeah, you think about it now, like almost every manufacturer has at least a sub one brand is a sub MOA guarantee on the gun. Like I think everybody out there, like Howa does it, Weatherby does it, Remington has it. I mean, everybody has a sub MOA gun now. And even on that, they all have their own chassis-built guns now, you know. Tika has a chassis. Ruger has a chassis. Remington has a chassis. Christensen has a chassis. All these guys, that's all because of the sport, you know. They're chasing what shooters want in this industry.
And so you – go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask, do you think the military has any influence on this at all?
I'd say a lot. I wouldn't say so much as on the competition side of it.
I mean as far as the production of these rifles.
Not really.
No? Okay.
No. I mean, they're pretty much locked into their contracts, and the units that do get what they want, they've already made that decision, you know?
Yeah. And Glenn, I was going to ask about that story you told me, because talking about all these improvements as far as guns,
but
glass is a huge improvement.
It is.
You told me that story that you're when you were hunting with your son and your dad, and you looked through the spotting scope, and I thought that was a pretty cool story.
You mean just seeing that deer?
Yeah.
Both. Yeah.
No, but how he brought up the difference of when he was hunting as a kid.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a good example. We'll get into that next if we want to talk about, you know, calibers and optics and things like that. But, you know, when my dad had an opportunity to go hunting with, you know, my oldest son and I last year, and as we're looking through these different optics, you know, my dad grew up in, as Josh knows and all you guys know, you know, grew up in the big game guide hunting business up in Jackson, where I'm from, up in Wyoming. And I mean, he was looking through what we kind of take for granted. He was looking through my Fury binos. And, of course, I'm on my spotting scope, and Dad's like, I want to see. And I'm like, here's some shitty binos. You know what I mean? And, it's just like, and these are still amazing glass. You know, it's like the Vortex razors with the built-in rangefinder. And I'm like, here, just use these binos, Dad. And he looks through them because I'm trying to get on the on this deer with this freaking spotting scope. And he's like, just mind blown.
He's like, right? Are you a wizard?
Yeah, exactly. He's like, is this magic? Like, holy shit. Like, we couldn't even – we wouldn't even seen that deer or been able to identify that deer back in the 50s when I was in the
running Tetons. The old Weaver fixed four.
Exactly. Yeah. He's like, you know, these old 10-power or 8-power binos we had with glass that was just barely good enough to even see through. And so we've definitely seen those kinds of upgrades, you know, over the years. Now, all that being said, I find it interesting sometimes, and I'd like to hear your opinion on this, Josh, where when we talk about guys like, let's say, Carlos Hathcock, right? Of course, a very famous, you know, Marine Corps sniper from Vietnam using a freaking Winchester Model 70, you know, rocking a 10-power fixed inertial scope. I mean, you're not talking about great equipment, capable equipment, but not necessarily great equipment. But he's making, you know, pretty long-range shots on the regular. So when you talk about the relationship of skills and tools. I mean, I would like to see a guy like that run modern equipment, you know, and the capabilities there would be incredibly interesting. I remember there was a video not too long ago, and I think you and I had talked about it, where they had that old World War II sniper, and they put him on some freaking like an M110 or something like that. I can't remember what they put him on.
I think it was an M110.
Like an AMU match rifle.
Yeah, yeah, some crazy. And he's just like punching 1,000-yard shots like it's going out of freaking style.
Yeah, it was awesome.
You know, and you're like, oh my gosh, like skill, right? Skill over tools. So in the match world, because we're going to talk about equipment a little bit next, in the match world, I know we certainly see it in training. We definitely see it in hunting. People try to buy that trophy. You know, they get drawn for a big bull or whatever. They got some big hunt coming up, and they're like, oh, cool. If I just get this big, huge caliber with this big, giant scope on it, I will be able to kill everything. And we definitely see it in training where people show up with, like, this badass $10,000 rig, and they're like, I'm going to be the best shooter in class. In competition, and really any aspect of the rifle, we usually see people try to buy that skill. What do you think is, like, the biggest detriment to people thinking – that way, that they're like, if I just spend enough, I can compete at this level, or I could shoot at this level, or I could hunt at this level, or I can kill at this level, or whatever. What do you think the biggest detriment is? A physical detriment? Is a mental detriment?
I'd say it'd be a financial detriment.
Yeah. Can't buy your way to the top.
Can't buy your way to the top, man. You can buy the best shit out there and put it in the wrong hands, it ain't going to do them any good.
Yeah. I see it, too, as a little bit of a mental detriment because people set themselves up in their minds to do something they're not capable of. You know, I mean, that's something that you and I have talked about at great lengths. It's like long-range hunting. You know, so people buy these big calibers and big scopes, and they get the data all printed out, and they're ready, and they're like, boom, I can make this shot on this animal, but they do not possess the skill, and they gut shoot some freaking deer at 800 yards and across the canyon, and it's like, well, good luck getting to that animal now before the sun goes down. And now we've either lost an animal, you've wounded an animal, you know, animal's going to get away, it's not going to be properly tagged. Then you're going to go off and shoot another animal, even though technically, ethically, you just filled your tag.
Yeah.
You know, and so we have those kinds of problems.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason, and I don't like talking about basic training, but there's a reason why we went to basic training that they – you
have a bad experience or what?
No, it's basic training's dumb.
Oh, okay.
when you get your rifle the first time, it's iron sights.
Yeah.
They try to build that foundation, the discipline of the fundamentals.
Sure.
Rather than just giving us an M4 with – an RDS or whatever type of variable sight.
Right.
They try to build that foundation. People coming into the competition world just buying exactly what they need to compete, they're skipping a few steps.
Now, is there a point, though, where you think if you have the money, right, is it more beneficial to go, hey, dude, I have the money, I should just get the good equipment, I want to learn how to use it, but I've got the extra whatever 10 grand sitting around. Let's just buy the best stuff because I've got it. Or do you think there is a benefit to say, okay, I have the money, but maybe I should get a basic system, learn how to use that the best, and then because I've got the funds, go ahead and upgrade to it, as opposed to the guy who's going to go like, I don't have the money, I got to scrape by with what I've got. Obviously, he's just got to do what he's got and hope to get something from a prize table or save up his money and get something better and kind of slowly progress. Do you think there's a benefit if someone does have the capability financially to buy something, just go ahead and buy the best? Or should they buy low and work to the higher point?
Buy once, cry once.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, if you have the money and money isn't an issue to you, there, why not? I'd buy the best of everything on the market and I'd figure out how to use it.
Now, as long as we're talking about the best of everything on the market, let's talk about the new calibers.
Oh, God.
Because, yeah, this is the rabbit hole, right? So this is going to be like a whole show almost. So we're going to try to keep it relatively simple. But there are so many new calibers out there.
Yeah.
What is the hotness right now?
6mm.
6mm Creed?
Nope. Some type of 6 variant. Either okay. It's a BR, BRA, BRX, GT, Dasher, 6 Creed, 6XC. There are so many 6mm out there now. It's just basically it's the round. That's people want the round and they don't really care how it gets pushed.
And how many of those are factory available? Like as far as ammunition is concerned?
Not very many.
Yeah.
6 Creed is 6 about
Creed, I know.
Your one factory. I mean, you can get some like – now, are you talking readily factory available like Hornady style, Federal style?
You could buy it somewhere from somebody.
Like HSM makes some of them. Okay. You know, there's little manufacturers out there, you know, sure. Do select batch stuff. But for the most part, if you want to be able to find it in a Sportsman's Warehouse or something like that, 6 Creed is about your
6mm Creed is the way to go. And is 6mm Creed compared to the other 6mm? Like I had an opportunity at one of the matches to kind of do a side-by-side match during some downtime comparison, I mean, between like a 6mm Dasher and a 6mm Creed that were both built on similar chassis. They weren't identical. They had similar optics, not identical. So it wasn't a perfect scientific evaluation here. But I noticed a significantly easier ability to spot my own hits with the 6 Dasher than the 6 Creed, even though they're both almost no freaking recoil.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that with all those different variants, like, is there really that big? And I wouldn't say it was so great that I'm like, oh my gosh, get rid of 6 Creedmoor. I'm 6 Dasher all the way. But do you think that there's that big of a difference between all those different variants that someone, let's say, with a 6 Creed is not going to be competitive against someone with any of the other 6mm variants?
No, you can still be competitive with it. I mean, old Phil Vallejo just won the PRS championship with the 6 Creedmoor. The match we just came from, Nico Detour took second with his 6 Creedmoor. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can still be competitive with it. A lot of people go to that BR, BRA, BR whatever, or Dasher, because of the inherent accuracy with it.
Mm-hmm.
Or the PPC. I mean, it's an inherently accurate round. That's what all the F-class guys shoot. This sport's trending that way. You need that inherent accuracy. It's easy to load for. You know, all these guys hand load anyway. Why not get it?
Now, when you look at calibers that are in competition, I mean, when we go back, like I mentioned, Carlos Hathcock, right? Those guys were shooting whatever, man, freaking 30-06 and 308 Winchester, because that's what they had. I mean, those were the options. They didn't have any cool stuff.
But you're looking at the military side.
Yes, but
the competition side back then,
yeah,
the old 243s and the 6mm Remington.
It's basically a 6mm.
Were the cool.
Yeah.
So basically all we've achieved in the last 50 years is a circle.
Yeah, right. Just a big old circle.
Yep. Well, nothing new, bro.
And my question is that with some of the new calibers, because looking at it from the military side and then also looking at it from the competitive side, because like you said, back then people were using freaking 6mm. Now we're using 6mm. We went away from it for a while, and now they're back. Yep. Everything old is new again. We know that in the training world, in this industry, you know. But do you see, like, the reason I mentioned what the military was using is because they were just using pretty standard, commonly available rounds. But now you're looking at, you know, the 300 PRC just getting picked up for military contract. Do you see the competitive side of things flowing more into the military side of things as opposed to vice versa? Like in the handgun carbine world, we see so much of the, I'll say, operational stuff flowing into the competition side. But especially with caliber specifically, and other maybe uses of equipment as well, but do you see more of the kind of operational flowing into the competition world, or do you see more of the competition world flowing into the operational side?
I would say for that, it really depend on what sport you're looking at. You know, like you're saying, like the pistol AR stuff, you know, the tactical side isn't giving advice to the three-gun open shooters or, you know, the pistol open shooters. You know, they have – that's two completely separate sports in itself. And that's kind of the same thing on, like, the PRS and NRL side with the tactical military guys. They're just playing a completely different game, you know, on caliber selection. Equipment-wise, you know, I think they have a lot of influence on what the military could use.
Now, moving from calibers, how about optics? Kind of the same question. What's the latest and greatest in optics out there? I mean, there's so many different reticles. There's so many different options. You've got, like, the freaking SIG optics that now Bluetooth connect to your freaking rangefinder. So you click your rangefinder on a target, and it Bluetooths it automatically to your scope, adjust the freaking crosshair for what you need, and boom, you lay it down. That's not really beneficial necessarily for the competition shooter because there's other things that you need to happen in between that process. But with a hunter, that could be wildly beneficial. You know, I tag this elk, laser bounces back at whatever 350 yards. It goes ahead and adjusts my reticle automatically for, you know, where I need to hold inside the gun. I get behind the gun, I make that shot, and I am quote unquote more accurate. What do you see with optics in the competition world? Because there's some crazy freaking reticles coming out now. There's some really weird stuff. Like, we were kind of joking after a SHOT Show about those 20th mil freaking optics adjust. You're like, dude, your bullet diameter is larger than that. Like, you can't necessarily adjust for that small of an adjustment.
But I mean, they're going after a certain clientele base. Mm. Like, even with that, you know, they're chasing the F-class shooters who measure their groups down to the thousands. Mm. You know, I mean, these guys are in a completely different realm than your PRS shooters are. On the PRS side, I mean, it's the same thing. We got, you know, all the optics companies are coming out with the new reticles, you know, specifically designed for the competition shooter.
And what are the big differences between a competition setup optic and, let's say, a more practical application optic, be it tactical application, hunting application, recreational application? What am I looking for in a competition optic? When you select your rifle to go, okay, I'm going to set this rifle up for competition, what are features you're looking for specifically in an optic?
So, like, we'll just say, for example, like the old H59, you know, that was the military reticle for a long time. And that was a great multi-purpose reticle because it did everything inside the reticle. It's also a very busy reticle. Mm. So if you've ever not looked through it, I mean, it's basically a grid pattern for the entire bottom half of the scope. Mm. So, like, in the competition side of that, you know, you need that speed. So they start pulling a lot of those lines out there, you know, dumb it down for a better sense of the word, make it easier, more easy use. Leave it a little more open, give you a little more clarity so you can spot those hits, spot your misses.
So what are you looking for? I mean, when you select an optic for competition, what are things that you're like, I need to have these features in my optic? What's the magnification level that you're looking for? What's the type of reticle you're looking for? Are there certain things you're looking for in a turret? Do you care about illumination? Things like that.
So for me personally, I want a field of view. I want a generous field of view. I want generous eye relief, and I want my magnification field doesn't really have to be that great. I mean, I run a Mark V CCH reticle right now, and I would say it's a 5 to 25. Mm. Majority of the time, I shoot on between 13 and 16 power with it. Mm. The only time I ever end up in that 25 range is, you know, bullseye shooting or trying to shoot groups.
Mm. How about illumination? Do you care about illumination?
I didn't until I went to a couple matches and they had night shoots.
I was going to say the exact same thing, dude. I didn't care about illumination until we went to that freaking team match up in Wyoming. And then I was like, oh, shit, I'm really glad I have illumination.
And that's the name of the game, you know. I actually shot a night match this year. I went and shot a night match. The entire match was shot at night, and they just illuminated all the targets. And I took illuminated reticle for that, and I actually switched my reticle up. I didn't take my CCH. I just took a regular TMR reticle just because of the way it was illuminated.
Nice, simple reticle, and the way it illuminates. Yep. How about turrets? Is there a certain turret system? Do you like locking turrets? Do you care about locking turrets?
I like locking turrets.
Why? What do you like about locking turrets? Because, you know, obviously everyone's got a different opinion on that.
But I like locking turrets because majority of these stages, there's movement involved, and it happens a couple times that you brush your arm across the top of your scope and spin your dial. And there you go. And there's a couple misses for you coming.
So, do you ever dial on windage?
I do.
And when do you dial on windage?
When I shoot movers.
Movers.
That's the only time I dial wind. There's people out there who dial it, and they have great ideas and concepts and ways to doing it. I've just shot long enough without dialing wind. I don't like dialing wind. It's one of those constants I want to don't want to have to do a negative hold because I have too much wind dialed on.
Well, I know, like, obviously from a, you know, from a training and teaching perspective in our programs, we're always teaching, you know, don't dial wind. We're always holding wind because holding, you know, wind is too much of a variable and it's possibility of moving too much. But when you're, I know sometimes, you know, you've shot matches, I've shot matches where you've got a 20 to 30 mile an hour freaking wind. So you know it's at least going to be 15.
Mm-hmm.
And so the closer I can hold typically to the crosshair, the easier it is to hold for wind for me, yeah. Right? And I know other people feel the same way. It's like the closer I can get to the crosshair, the easier it is to hold for wind. The farther away I have to count, the farther away I have to get, the harder it is for me to hold, the slower it is for me to get there, especially if I have to count. So, you know, I may dial on a 15 mile an hour wind.
Yeah, we have, if it's something crazy, I mean, we got like 20 mile an hour winds and it's like 1,300 yards and I'm going to be out there like 8 mils or something like that. You know, you're going to have to dial that on, obviously, just to get it into your reticle.
Mm. So there are appropriate times, but when we're generally talking about just shifting winds,
yeah, it's a normal stage, 5 to 6 to 10 mile an hour winds, I'm not going to dial it on.
Now, skill sets, the last thing that we'll talk about here before we wrap it up is skill sets that people need to work on. Like, what are the things that you see most people are just, they're just not ready for when they show up to a competition?
Shooting other than prone. Most people come to long range matches thinking it's going to be a prone match, and they're not. You need to be comfortable shooting off barricades, off of tires, off of, I mean, barrels, you name it.
Now, how about gear management? Like, that's always something I see people have a problem with, is just like knowing where your gear is, how it attaches to your body, how it interacts with your gun, how it interacts with your body. You know, when you're trying to get things into position, everything. I always see gear management be a problem. Is that something that you see a lot of, where people are fighting their gear?
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like a freaking liability as opposed to an asset.
It is a liability at a certain time. I mean, because you have the ability to buy so much new, cool gear, and then you want to try it because you've seen somebody else use it. But if you've never trained with it, like tripods in particular, people love trying to shoot off tripods, and it's something they've never done before. But if they see the guy in front of them who shoots off a tripod all the time clean a stage with his tripod, they think that's the greatest thing in the world.
It looks easy.
It looks easy. And they're like,
yeah, shooting from a tripod looks easy.
Well, he just did it. I'm going to go do it. And then it's just a goat fuck. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, I feel bad for you. Yeah. Like, just don't.
Oh, yeah.
So what are things that people can really work on? Positional shooting, you know, knowing their gear. I would say the good data, like we talked about, you know, having solid data at least out to 800-900.
Data's easy.
And start working on
that. I mean, with the Kestrel ballistics program, geoballistics program. I mean, it's almost like cheating at this point.
It is. Remember how long it took you to convert me to that? I was like so against it.
Glenn had come out with this paper. He's like, nope.
I'm like,
nope. I don't even want to look at it. I have my paper.
I got my paper and my calculator. Leave me alone. And now I'm converted. Ballistic.
I've shot matches with Glenn, and he used his breakfast napkin.
I used the back of a freaking Corona beer box one time as my data card. Yeah, I get a little ghetto sometimes, but it's the capability to run these programs with handheld weather meters and pull your external ballistics on site.
Yeah.
And then adjust your data on site. I mean, at this point, if you're not using that, you are not going to do well.
Yes and no. I mean, there's still a place where I like having secondary backups. Like, I have a data card. I print out a data card for the DA for the day prior of the range that I'm shooting at, because we all know electronics fail. Mm-hmm. So you should always have a secondary card. And that secondary card is good enough for the matches, but it's not, you know, a 0.1 difference or a 0.2 difference isn't going to cost you a match because you forgot to bring a set of double A's.
Right.
Or your phone died because you're looking at Facebook.
And that's typically what I do is I'll pull it in the morning, and unless there's a massive freaking weather change, I put that away because I'm always worried about busting my phone or something. Mm-hmm. I know you and I know other shooters who literally just have like their old phone or a second phone or whatever that's just used for that process. Yep. That way if you bust it or break it or whatever, it's not your primary freaking communication device. But I only have the one, so it's like for me, I pull it in the morning. I put that stuff away. I write down what my DA is, what my, you know, temperature and elevation was, whatever. I put that on my armband. That's my card. I generally am always pulling off my card.
And that works.
But I'm using that computer now to make sure that I'm getting the proper adjustments because, I mean, there was a match. In fact, it might have been the Dog Valley match where I remember first thing in the morning, first target, I just sailed one right over the top of a target. I'm like, the fuck is that? You know? And I finished up the stage. Everything was good. I made my adjustments appropriately. And I came over to you. I'm like, dude, what do you think happened? You're like, well, dude, what's your DA? And it's like, oh, shit. I forgot to freaking, you know, pull my external ballistics that were different. It was colder, I think, the second morning than it was the first morning or something like that. So if you're going to do the card thing, you have to make sure that if you're going to use the program, you got to, you know, update it pretty regularly. So what are other skill sets that you see that people just aren't doing or that people are doing? Maybe that's a better way to think of it. Like, what are things that you've worked on specifically that you've seen, hey, when I do this or when I practice this, I see a massive increase in my performance at a match?
I'd say the time management is a big one that probably helped most people. Most people seem to time out a lot. So building that shooting position, you know, you shouldn't just shoot as soon as you get on the target. Build a solid position that you can have multiple shots taken off of. Because if you have to rebuild it every single time, it's going to cost you more time in the long run.
How about prior preparation? Do you think sometimes our prior preparation is like Jameson or whatever the night before. But what do you – overall prior preparation, like, do you think physical fitness – and I know that's kind of match dependent because we do some matches that are more adventure race, overland type stuff. But a general PRS NRL match is not physically demanding as far as like you got to move your shit all over the place.
It's still taxing though because you got to think of the location that these places are being held to get – that 1,000 yards in every direction to shoot these matches. You're out in the middle of nowhere, so accommodations are going to be minimal. You know, and that's taxing on a body throughout an entire day. You're outside all day in the sun taxing your brain and staring through glass. You know, hydration, physical fitness, all that comes into a big play.
Do you do anything? Like, do you have like a ritual you do before a match, so to speak, where like, a certain way you prep your gear, a certain way you prepare yourself, your mind, your body, whatever it is, where you're like, this is something I do to make sure, other than the gummy bears, of course, but is there something else where you're like, this is what I do
to make sure
that I know that I'm ready to go?
So I do all my gear prep night prior. Hydration wise, you know, body armors are great. I try and drink a body armor at least every night before I go to bed. During the match, like you said, the gummy bear secret, I carry a pack of gummy bears just for that little energy boost to keep you on the level.
So anything else you can think of that's like a real big change or trend or anything kind of moving forward in competition or long range that we haven't already talked about?
Big trends.
Anything you're seeing that's like, man, this is a piece of freaking equipment to have, or this type of thing, you should get this kind of pack, or this is something that's really helped you as a competitor?
No, it's just like everything's big full circle, you know. The bags got crazy for a while, then everybody goes to the tripods, then they go to the tabletops, now they're going back to the bags, and, you know, some new tripod's going to probably come out next week. And it's just an ever-evolving process, you know. Gear's always going to keep changing.
And so I think, like, we've talked about gear quite a bit. We just want to make sure you're not chasing the gear. Because it's so easy to go to a match and be like, oh, I could have done better if I'd had that. I could have done better if I'd had that. And next thing you know, you're $500, $1,000, $1,500 into gear. You're still not a better shooter because you still lack the shooting fundamentals. You still lack the understanding of what you're doing. You know, do you think more shooters would benefit from more training, you know, from a professional aspect? Do you think people would benefit more from more dry practice? Or do you think people benefit more from just more matches?
Dry practice.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, majority of people probably go shoot the match, clean their gun, put it away, pull it out, and go shoot the next match. Mm-hmm. You know, getting that dry practice in is where you're going to see a big improvement. If you have the funding available, go get some professional training, you know. Go meet the guys who know how to do it and figure out the ways that they do it and why they think the way they do about why how they shoot stages, you know, why they run the gear that they run. Mm-hmm.
Anything that you recommend, last thing that we'll talk about here, is any particular equipment, manufacturers, anything like that you're like, these are the people I go with beyond a shadow of a doubt. These guys are good to go. I mean, you're a Leupold sponsored shooter, much to my heart's demise, but so Leupold Optics, of course.
Obviously, Leupold makes the best.
Obviously, in the world, but. Leupold makes the Today's show brought to you by Vortex Optics. All right. So Leupold Optics, which do make phenomenal quality glass, very durable, very good glass. And I think that that's something that people overlook, is the quality of glass is so important.
Quality glass really is important. I mean, you really – that is probably one big deciding factor, because, I mean, everybody spends all the money on the guns. I mean, a competition rifle is no cheap entry fee. You're looking at the $2,000 to $5,000 mark for that, and then when you have to match that with a set of optics, you know, that's a hard pill to swallow to put that much money into one setup. But it's a necessary evil, if you will, because there's nothing worse than having a $3,000 rifle with a $100 scope.
Yeah.
So Walmart's not going to cut it.
Walmart won't do you no favor.
Tesco's not going to cut it.
So Leupold Optics, which of course makes great optics. Who else, any other manufacturers that you use where you're like, man, I just know these guys are good to go and I recommend them no matter what?
Just on the optics side or across the board?
Across the board for all the stuff we've been talking about, just the long range precision shooting world.
I'd say across the board. I'd go back and I'd look at the people putting money into the industry. And those are the people I would look at, because they're the ones getting actual feedback from those guys shooting. So if you had a chance to look at like a sponsor book or the back page, you know, look at one of those and look who's, you know, truly looking to innovate and bring some new products to the table, because those are the people I would want to be, you know, I'm going to give them my money because they're actually vested in it. You know, they're not relying on something that happened 20 years ago to sell their brand because it's outdated.
And you see a consistency in that too.
Oh, you definitely do. You definitely can see who sponsors the sports, who pushes to innovate the sports, and where their money's going. You know, those are the people you want to back, because they're there. They know what the new trend is. They know what the shooters want, and they're going to innovate that to make that happen. They're getting that new technology. So those are the people you want to go after.
Well, thanks for coming in and talking with us, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, buddy.
Remember, you guys can always bring us out to train with you if you want to. You know, Josh, of course, works with us over Independence Training. So if you want to bring us out for a long-range class or any of the other programs we teach, you can email us info@trainingaz.com. We'll give you all the hosting information. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Instagram as The Arms Room Show, Independence Training, and Red Wire Gear. We're proud members of the Heroes Media Group. Check out some of the other shows and their coffee, which isn't actually that bad. I'm always like, oh, another veteran branded coffee company, but there's actually pretty good stuff.
Are they going to make protein?
I'm sure it's coming. They need t-shirts. Yeah, t-shirts and a protein.
T-shirts, stickers, patches, and coffee.
Yeah,
you're kidding me.
Oh, he's almost there, man. He's just rounding. Come on, Adam, get on it. I need some t-shirts. Next week's show, we're going to be talking about preparing the workplace and your workforce for emergencies, not just active shooters, but general emergencies. And we've got a couple of really good points to bring up to you guys. So until next time, stay aware, stay safe, and train hard. You've been listening to The Arms Room.